All right, so I've been promising you more details on this most Michigan of church events for the last few weeks, right? This upcoming Euchre tournament and potluck, and so I'm going to give some of those details later today, as well as some framing for why we're raising money for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, sometimes called MIRC. We've invited Amanda Schwartz, who's a lawyer who works for MIRC, who is visiting us today, and she's going to come up and speak in a little bit here to tell us a little bit about the organization and just put some human stories on the work that they do so that we have a little better understanding. But before we get to that, I first want us to remember a story from the Bible together. And it's a story from a book of Ruth, which is a story about a young immigrant woman. Right? And so that book was written in a time period when there was a lot of discussion about immigrants in the community for various reasons. And on one far end of the spectrum, there were some people who were advocating for all immigrants to be expelled without distinction. Right? If you were married to an immigrant, divorce them. If you had kids with them, send them away. Right? That's an extreme end. And we don't actually know if that even happened, but that voice is in there. But one of the helpful things about the Bible is that it records different streams of thinking during such times, right? It's not like a manual that's trying to tell us one way to think about things, and I saw this first, so this is what we do, right? It has many, many voices so that we can see these different viewpoints that have a framework for thinking about hard things. And it's thought that the book of Ruth came out as like a counter-narrative in that time to that extreme view, right? It was a way of saying, hey, let's just hold on a second. Let's think about things with a little more nuance. And so I want to share that story in brief so that we have a little scaffolding this morning. That story goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a woman called Naomi. And Naomi lived near Bethlehem with her family. She had a husband and two sons. But there was a famine in the land. And so they decided to pick up their family, and they were going to move to a land called Moab. And the people, they were called Moabites. Now, there was a long-standing distrust among Naomi's people of the Moabite people. And that was for a couple of reasons. The first one is the Moabites had this sort of shady origin story that we won't get into this morning, but it's found in Genesis 19, right? So they were considered a little bit sus. And it was also said that the Moabites had refused to help Naomi's people, the Hebrew people, when they were fleeing from slavery in Egypt centuries before. And so the Moabites had been barred from being part of the Hebrew community. But Moab had food at this time. And so Naomi and her family moved there in spite of the reputation of the Moabites. Well, soon after she moved there, Naomi's husband died, leaving her a widow. And her son settled down and they married local Moabite women, and their family stayed there in the region for about 10 years. And neither of Naomi's kids had any children. And then at the end of those 10 years, both of her sons died. And so that left just Naomi there, along with her son's two widows, these Moabite women. So Naomi, she hears that there's food again back in her hometown in Bethlehem. And so she decides to go home. And so both of her daughters-in-law, they pack up to go with her. And soon after they set out, Naomi turns to them and she's like, why don't you guys just go home? Like, why would you come with me? I don't have anything more to give you. I don't have any more sons. And so one of the daughters-in-law was like, you know what, you're right. And so she goes home. But the other one, whose name was Ruth, she said, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. Right? So it's clear that Ruth loved her mother-in-law, Naomi, very much. And we don't know Ruth's situation. We don't know. Maybe she didn't have a family to go back to. Or maybe Naomi was better to her than her family. We can only wonder at what her situation was that caused her to pick up and move. But the two of them did. They picked up and they went back to Bethlehem. And when they arrived, it says that the whole town was stirring. Right? You have to understand, Bethlehem was like a small agricultural town. Everybody knew everybody. People remembered Naomi. You know, she left 10 years ago, but now she's back, only she's got this like Moabite woman in tow. We don't know what that's about. So Naomi had roots in Bethlehem, but Ruth, she was an immigrant, she was a widow, and she was poor. Right? Three strikes in the ancient world. You might add being a woman to that, right? She arrived in Bethlehem with little social protection, no land, no husband. And so these two grieving women, they lived together and they took care of each other. But without husbands or fathers, they didn't have much hope for a life outside of like getting by. They could get by though, right? They could eat. It was barley harvesting time. And there was this law in the Torah that instructed Jewish farmers to leave grain at the edges of their fields unharvested, right? So kind of like a ring around the field. And they were also instructed not to go over their fields twice, right? So if you're imagining they got like a machete and they go through and they're harvesting their barley or their other grain, often you miss something, so you go back over it. And it says, don't do that. Leave that food there so that the poor and the widows and the foreigners can come and take grain for their families. Right? So in other words, God and their people built compassion into the economic system so that no one would go hungry. And so Ruth went out day after day, gleaning the leftover barley out under the heat. And gleaning's hard work, right? It's working at the edges of the fields. And Ruth was a hard worker, as many immigrants are. It's like that song in Hamilton, right? Immigrants, get the job done. It's like working on the margins of society, doing what you can. It means being both visible and somewhat invisible at the same time. Right? It's like you're seen enough to be noticed, right? The town was all a Twitter. She's different. There's a Moabite woman here, right? She's a vulnerable woman out there working in the field. But you're also kind of not noticed enough to feel as protected as others. Like, who would come to your aid? But then the story brings in a character called Boaz, who's the owner of this field where Ruth's been picking grain. And Boaz doesn't ask Ruth how she got there. He doesn't interrogate her motives. He doesn't tell her she should be grateful for scraps or tell her that she's just entitled because she wants to eat. All he knows is that she lives with Naomi and she takes care of her. And so Boaz shows concern for Ruth's dignity. And the first thing he tends to is her safety. Right? He tells the men that he's hired to help him with the harvest that they can't lay a hand on her. Because if they touch her, that they will answer to him because he knows that she's vulnerable to being harassed or worse. The next thing that Boaz does is he instructs the workers to leave extra grain, right? Even more than they normally would leave for the poor and the widow and the foreigner, right? And he does that so that the work will be easier and to make sure she gets all the food that she needs. And then he invites Ruth to come and eat lunch with the rest of his workers so that she has a midday meal as she's working out in the hot sun. And he publicly affirms her worth as a human, going beyond the minimum required of him as a good Jewish man. Right, so the character of Boaz communicates to us that showing compassion to immigrants, it's not meant to be something of like reluctant compliance, of like, well, I guess I'm supposed to do this. The attitude is more one of like active hospitality. Right? He treats Ruth not as like a problem to manage, but she's a neighbor to protect. And eventually Boaz marries Ruth at her prompting, and they go on to have children. And probably the most disruptive part of that story is that in the end, we learn that Ruth is the grandmother of King David, right? The beloved Israeli king, the one who's said to have written a lot of the Psalms, right? David and Goliath, that David. And so King David has an immigrant grandmother, which has its own implications in a matrilineal society. But whether or not there was actually a woman named Ruth who was the grandmother of King David isn't even really the point. It was that in a time when some people were calling for an indiscriminate expulsion of all immigrants, this story enters the scene and says, well, wait a minute here, maybe hashtag not all immigrants. I think it invites people to entertain nuance, to have empathy with individual stories, and to ask, are immigrants to be seen only as threats, or are they actually quite vulnerable on many levels? You know, maybe some pose a reasonable threat, but what about my friend Ruth, that Moabite woman who comes to synagogue with me, right? That doesn't seem to describe her. And that's the power of a story, right? To try and get us out of that sort of black and white thinking. And you might be saying, oh yeah, and you're probably preaching to the choir here this morning. I probably am, but I know some of you have some pretty conservative family members who are Christian. And so that might be like a way of having that sort of discussion with them to talk about what Ruth is bringing to that conversation, right? In our own context today, I think that there's a variety of ways that we can approach immigration policy and be faithful Christians, right? I think I tend to agree with, there was a letter put out by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. It was like last spring, And I thought they did a really great letter, actually, that they overwhelmingly approved. It was like 216 of them approved and 5 did not, right? But they said, we recognize that nations have a responsibility to regulate their borders and establish a just and orderly immigration system for the sake of the common good. Without such processes, immigrants face the risk of trafficking and other forms of exploitation. Safe and legal pathways serve as an antidote to such risks. Right, so safe and legal pathways for citizenship that don't take 10 to 20 years to navigate are desperately needed for so many reasons. I've had friends who have been deeply impacted by that broken system. I think the place that we can all agree as Christians, regardless of how we feel about like specific border policies, is on the humane treatment of people. Right, and this is where I thought the letter from the Catholic bishops really shone. And so I'm going to just read out some of their concerns and then add a couple of my own just to give voice to them in our setting. They said, we're disturbed when we see among our people a climate of fear and anxiety around questions of profiling and immigration enforcement. We're concerned about the conditions in the detention centers. I've looked more deeply into that, just lack of access to medical care. Sounds like 32 people died in custody this last year, more than in the last 4 years combined. According to the ACLU, there's been rationed food, spoiled food, sometimes enough food for 50 people when there's 70 people who have to split the food, physical and sexual assaults, and lack of access to legal counsel, which I'm sure Amanda will expound on. The bishops continue by saying, we lament that some immigrants in the United States have arbitrarily lost their legal status. That's horrifying. We're troubled by threats against the sanctity of houses of worship, the special nature of hospitals and schools, right, that you shouldn't have to be afraid to seek medical treatment or send your kids to school or to worship. We're grieved when we meet parents who fear being detained when taking their children to school and when we try to console family members who have already been separated from their loved ones. We oppose the indiscriminate mass deportation of people. And I would add 3 things to this list. Concern that we're no longer accepting asylum seekers, that we've closed the border to that. And that includes many gay people who come from countries where they'll be killed, Christians fleeing persecution, people fleeing war. We as a congregation helped resettle a family from Afghanistan who aided the United States a few years ago, people who would be killed by the Taliban if they went home. Concern about the lack of a path of accountability for some federal enforcement officers. And concern for families sending their kids back to the countries where their kids have never lived. And like a friend of my sister's did that, like she's been here legally working on a visa, had kids, her kids are now 18. They don't have a great path for citizenship, so they have to send them back to a country where they have never lived, you know, with extended family. Like, is that just, right? And I think things like the story of Ruth asks us to invite, like, wow, like, can there be nuance? Does this work in every case, right? And so with that, I'd like to invite Amanda to come up, and she's going to share with us a little bit about Merck and a little bit about some of what she's seeing, and then I'll come tell you a little bit more about our Euchre tournament. Welcome, Amanda.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to speak today. My name is Amanda Schwartz, and I'm a staff attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, or Merck. I'm going to just share some information about Merck and what we do to advocate for our immigrant neighbors. It's been a difficult year, but it's great to see so many people coming together to learn more about the issues and learn their voices to advocate for change. First, a little bit about Merck. The Michigan Immigrant Rights Center is a statewide legal resource center for Michigan's low-income immigrant communities. We work to build a state where immigrant communities experience equity and belonging through areas of legal service, systemic advocacy, community engagement, and education. We are the state's largest provider of free legal services for immigrants. We serve all unaccompanied children in federal custody, and most who have been released to different sponsors throughout the entire state. We serve farm workers, victims of crime and domestic violence, people applying for asylum, naturalization, and a host of other legal needs. We are the only organization that individuals can call from detention to receive free legal advice and one of few organizations who are doing deportation defense. We have a small team also doing policy advocacy and trying to change unjust policies at the federal, state, and local level that affect immigrant communities. We have 5 offices across the state. Although we are the largest nonprofit immigration legal services program in the state, we do not have unlimited resources or the ability to assist everyone seeking these services. There are 31,000 Michiganders in deportation hearings today, which is double from 2023, and only about 1/3 of those have legal representation. Having a lawyer makes a huge difference. 62% of immigrants without a lawyer were deported at the conclusion of their immigration hearings, compared to 27% of those who had a lawyer. We do the best we can with the resources we have to provide a range of these services, and we make referrals to other attorneys as well. Sadly, we do not have sufficient resources to represent or assist everyone, though. There's simply not enough free or low-cost attorneys across the state. We've struggled with this need for years now, and it's only more painful now. Also, for many immigrants, the law as it stands today does not even provide a path to legal status. One of the myths that I wish most to dispel about immigration to the United States is that there is a path for legal status for any immigrant who is willing to do it the right way or wait their turn in line. For many people, there is no line, and there is no way for them to get residency here, even with an attorney. So that's why our policy team also keeps working to change the system itself. Some of the unfortunate trends that we've been seeing in the past year is that there's been a massive increase in immigration enforcement across the state with big funding behind it. The executive branch has a lot of power to determine the enforcement priorities of the enforcement of the immigration enforcement agents. And so it's no longer the case where those immigration enforcement officers are prioritizing people who have committed serious crimes. Now they are pursuing high school students, parents, workers, community members. Also, the location of where these arrests are taking place has also changed. There used to be a sensitive locations policy, which directed officers to use their discretion and avoid pursuing enforcement at places of worship, schools, playgrounds, hospitals, and other locations where people are trying to access essential services. That policy has been revoked, which gives enforcement officers the discretion to pursue immigrants at any of these sensitive locations. What you can do, you can go to our website and check our Take Action page and contact your elected officials. You can share Know Your Rights information with your community. And you can also contribute to this fundraiser because legal services are a huge help and one of the biggest needs that our immigrant communities face. I also, before I conclude, just want to take a moment to talk about my work and my clients and put a bit of a human face on it. I joined Merck 5 years ago. It's my first job out of law school, so I've been doing this my whole career. And I was on the unaccompanied children's team. So I'd say about 95% of my caseload are children. I represented 2 brothers from Afghanistan whose father had worked at a U.S. military base, providing security to U.S. troops stationed there. And after the Taliban took over in August of 2021, they were able to access all the government records. So the Taliban was able to identify the exact families who had collaborated with the U.S. government, putting a huge target on them. The 2 brothers that I represented, their family fled from Kabul to the airport, which they described to me as complete chaos. The family was all separated in this mob with so many Afghanis trying to get out and get on these U.S.-funded evacuation flights. The 2 brothers were able to get on a flight, and they were able to come to the U.S. They were separated from their father, but he was able to get on a different flight, and they were reunited in Chicago, and they're now living in Detroit. I represented them in their asylum case, and the interview for the asylum case was held in Chicago. And myself and the family, we stayed downtown in Chicago at this run-of-the-mill budget hotel, you know the type, two queen beds, clean enough, mini fridge, continental breakfast with the waffle machine. But it was a three-story hotel, and on the top of the hotel, there was a little pool, and if you stood there at night, you were surrounded by all the Chicago skyscrapers, and they were all lit up. And so we stayed there that night, and the next morning we met in the lobby right before their asylum interview, and the brothers came up to me and they were showing me all the selfies they had taken on this rooftop with all the skyscrapers and all the lights, and they thanked me profusely for arranging this day, and they told me it was the most incredible place they had ever stayed in their whole lives and how they would remember this hotel for the rest of their lives. And we went on to win their asylum case, and today they are legal permanent residents here. I tell you this story because it reflects what I consider to be the best part of my job, which is the opportunity to see the world anew through the eyes of my clients. Surrounded by so much darkness, it's very easy to feel discouraged, but then I remember that a hotel that I honestly probably never would have thought twice about staying in again was a magical night for my clients. I remember another child that I worked with. I asked him what was the most surprising part to him about moving to the United States, and he answered that there's always food on the grocery shelves here. My clients serve as constant reminders of all the blessings that growing up here we take for granted. And because of them, I'm so much more appreciative of all the good fortune that we do still have. And I try to keep that in mind. Thank you so much for inviting me to your sanctuary and for your commitment to Michigan immigrants' communities. It was my honor to be able to sit in on this service and to speak to you here today.